Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Dulce Guzman, Executive Director of Alianza Americas, who discusses her group's alarm at the Trump regime's deportation of U.S. citizen children and the arrest of a judge that threatens all Americans' right to due process. Reed Mackey, Director of Advocacy with the Child Labor Coalition, who examines the current right-wing assault on protective child labor laws in states across the U.S. And Gareth Gore, an investigative journalist, who talks about his new book that examines Opus Dei, the secret conservative sect within the Catholic Church, and its many ties with Donald Trump's right-wing MAGA movement. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Donald Trump's trade war has shaken global markets and confidence in the U.S. dollar. After Trump threatened to fire Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell for not lowering U.S. interest rates, the stock market cratered. Meanwhile, the U.S. economy appears headed toward a recession, where a growing number of consumers fear tariff-triggered inflation will cost working families thousands of dollars over the next year. According to a recent survey, consumer confidence has fallen by 32% since January, the steepest drop since the 1990 recession. Over many decades, when investors fear economic instability, they normally rush to the safety of reliable U.S. Treasury bonds. But after Trump launched his erratic and irrational trade war, The Economist reports that investors are dumping treasuries, the interest on bonds are trending higher, and the dollar has fallen over 9% against other currencies since its peak in mid-January. For decades, America's currency has been the linchpin of global trade and finance. About half of all lending across borders is in dollars. But Trump's attempt to weaponize Washington's economic power and his attack on the rule of law pose the greatest threat so far to the dollar's status as a reserve currency. Should that threat be realized, growth will be slower, people will be poorer, and U.S. isolation won't bring the promised manufacturing revival that Trump claims is his goal. Trump appointees at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency are planning to eliminate long-standing requirements for polluters to collect and report their emissions of the heat-trapping gases that cause climate change. According to ProPublica, the rules change could reduce the number of industrial facilities mandated to report greenhouse gas emissions from 8,000 to 2,500 facilities in certain sectors of the oil and gas industry. The loss of this data will make it harder to know how much climate warming gas that an economic sector or factory is emitting. This data allows for accountability because the government can't curb the country's emissions without knowing where they're coming from. EPA Administrator Lee Zeldin, a former New York Republican representative, says the reporting program is burdensome, costing American businesses millions of dollars, echoing a recommendation in Project 2025, the far-right blueprint for Trump's presidency. Critics fear the Trump move will harm the global effort to address the climate crisis and cause developing nations like India, China, and Indonesia to follow the U.S. example and stop their own reporting of carbon emissions. In Sri Lanka's northern agricultural heartland, many farming families have been devastated by a worsening pattern of floods and drought caused by the intensifying climate crisis. Foreign Policy magazine reports that Sri Lanka is among the world's countries most vulnerable to climate impacts. As erratic extreme weather events become more frequent, farming has become an increasingly precarious livelihood. As farm families face more economic hardship, many of Sri Lanka's women are migrating to the Middle East to find work, particularly in Kuwait, Lebanon, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates, a trend that is on the rise along with climate disruption. In September, Sri Lanka elected its first leftist president, Anura Dissanayake of the Socialist National People's Power Party. His party's manifesto pledges to build a sustainable world, which includes ensuring environmental justice and emphasizes the need for gender equality. But it is too soon to tell how his ambitious plans will be implemented. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
As Donald Trump completed his first 100 days of his second term in the White House, the twice-impeached convicted felon has issued 142 executive orders, employed billionaire Elon Musk to dismantle federal agencies, fire tens of thousands of government workers, slash congressionally approved budgets for healthcare research, education, foreign aid, and sabotage the Social Security system. At the same time, Trump has also aggressively exacted retribution against his perceived political enemies. That includes law firms, universities, media outlets, former staff members, and anyone identified as a critic of his regime. Trump's imposition of unprecedented tariffs on nations around the world has wreaked havoc on the stock and bond market, severely weakened the U.S. dollar, ramped up inflation, and set the stage for a damaging recession. Although Trump focused his 2024 election campaign on demonizing immigrants of color, pledging to deport millions who he falsely stereotyped as violent criminals, his administration is now deporting many legal U.S. residents, international students, and people accused of being gang members based solely on their tattoos, all without due process. The president continues to defy a Supreme Court order to return Maryland resident Kilmar Abrego Garcia to the U.S., who was mistakenly sent to a brutal prison in El Salvador. More recently, the Trump regime has deported three children who are U.S. citizens to Honduras with their mothers, including a four-year-old receiving treatment for metastatic cancer. Trump's FBI dramatically escalated its assault on the courts on April 25th when agents arrested Milwaukee Circuit Court Judge Hannah Dugan for allegedly helping an undocumented man in her courtroom avoid arrest by ICE agents. Your reporter spoke with Dulce Guzman, executive director of Alianza Americas, who discusses her group's growing concern about Trump's mass deportation policy that's denying those targeted with due process, which legal scholars warn threatens all Americans' constitutionally guaranteed rights.
It's really a horrific moment that we're living here in the U.S. right now. It was really a publicity stunt to show a picture of a sitting judge being handcuffed and walked to a police vehicle. I think that the remarks by Attorney General Pam Bondi says it all. They are trying to weaponize and politicize the judicial system so that they can get by with continuing to violate the U.S. Constitution. Many of the things that they are doing right now is plain lawlessness. We are very concerned with this situation because, as we know, the judiciary is a co-equal branch of this government, and what we're seeing is a complete disregard for their authority and for them doing their job of making sure that we're following laws and that the executive is also using his power by abiding by the Constitution.
Dulce, there's been growing attention on three young children who are U.S. citizens who've been deported by the Trump administration to Honduras. One of those children is suffering with stage 4 metastatic cancer and was deported without being able to consult with a lawyer or a doctor, or I believe it was his father, who could have taken custody of that child to continue his cancer treatment. This seems like another instance of reckless carelessness or cruelty, intentional cruelty.
Yes. I mean, you could see it on Tom Holman's face that when he was interviewed, I don't know if it was over the weekend or earlier today, but when he was asked about the situation, he tried to evade as if he wasn't aware or didn't have the details, because he knows that it's wrong. They're trying to excuse themselves, trying to categorize us all as criminals, but I think we can clearly see that their agenda really is to pick and choose who gets to be in this country, who gets to be protected as a U.S. citizen, because as we're seeing, it's even U.S. citizen children, people that are also getting caught in this just irresponsible way of enforcing our laws. So I think that we need to continue raising these stories because they're being reckless, as you said. They're not following the procedures that are put in place to ensure that things like this don't happen.
Well, Dulce, I also wanted to ask you about the Trump regime's decision to continue defying federal courts and the 9-0 Supreme Court ruling to facilitate the return of Maryland resident and father, Kilmer Abrego Garcia, back to the U.S., from a brutal prison in El Salvador, where he was flown to El Salvador mistakenly, although he is a legal U.S. resident. Trump administration officials continually refer to him as a gang member and a terrorist without any facts to back that up.
Yes. And that's, I think, something that we are trying to raise the alarms anywhere that will hear us, or that we, you know, try to make ourselves heard, because this is something that doesn't just impact immigrants that are getting caught in this reckless system, but it's going to affect U.S. citizens. And we've heard it directly from Trump that they're looking into ways to do this to U.S. citizens. I think that Abrego Garcia's case is an emblematic case because it's a really clear example of what is currently happening. But there's also 260 other individuals that are currently sitting in that El Salvador prison who we don't know really what evidence or reason, you know, they had for getting caught up in this. And I think that we're really seeing that the importance of due process. We can't have an argument about whether or not somebody should be arrested or detained, because they're just cutting straight through and saying, because you look like this, or because, you know, you have this tattoo on you, we think you belong in a prison.
Dulce, I did want to talk to you more about that issue of, this is not an issue of due process just for immigrants. If the Trump administration can defy U.S. courts and even the Supreme Court to have masked agents pick up citizens and non-citizens, anyone in the U.S., and deport them to a foreign prison with no hope of ever being released, no court adjudication of guilt or innocence, then democracy is over in this country, is it not?
Yeah, I 100% agree and believe in that. The administration talks a lot about public safety and national safety and interest. But really, what is a democracy and what is safety if nobody really has individual rights? What does having a free system, quote unquote, mean if you could be picked up at any second? If you're not given the opportunity to prove yourself or present a case and have a court justly decide based on evidence and fact whether or not you have committed a crime. I think that this is a very serious and delicate moment, and I think people need to continue speaking up about this before it gets even worse.
That was Dulce Guzman, executive director of the group Alianza Americas. Learn more about what immigrant rights advocates are doing to challenge the Trump administration's lawless mass deportations by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The Fair Labor Standards Act was passed in 1938, which went a long way toward eliminating dangerous child labor in the U.S. Now these protections are being eroded, especially among migrant children. A majority of U.S. states have taken action or are considering legislation that would weaken protections for child workers who have always been allowed to work in agriculture starting at age 12. The campaign to end U.S. child labor includes dozens of unions, educational, and social service organizations. Their shared agenda calls for the protection of unaccompanied migrant children, increased enforcement, proposing strong legislation to hold corporations accountable for child labor law violations, and mandating corporate funding to eradicate child labor from supply chains. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Reed Mackey, Director of Child Labor Advocacy for the internationally focused Child Labor Coalition and the National Consumers League, which is also a co-founder of the campaign to end U.S. child labor. Here he talks about the current assault on protective child labor laws in states across the U.S.
There have been, I think, over 30 states that have looked at weakening child labor laws. Well, when you take a really close look, it's not quite as dire as it might seem initially. There have been some states where there's been kind of an egregious attempt to weaken protections, like Iowa is an example of that, you know, where they salted child labor protections from a variety of angles, including like hours and putting kids into somewhat harmful workplaces. And there's currently a bill in Florida that we really hate that would basically like older teens, 16 and 17 year olds, and some younger teens work really long hours, like overnight hours before school. You can't even fathom how they could come up with a plan, you know, that would impact children so much that, you know, how can they possibly work all night and then go to school? It has been something we have seen in some of these instances of child labor in recent years, you know, kids working in the meatpacking plants and cleaning crews were working all night and then trying to go to school, where, of course, they fell asleep often. There was a very big DOL investigation that came out in February of 2023, U.S. Department of Labor investigation, and it found kids working in 13 facilities. I believe it was in 8 states. So it was really spread. You know, it wasn't really localized to a specific region. You know, these were meat processing plants, and the kids were mostly immigrant children, a lot of them unaccompanied minors that had come across the border. Very, very vulnerable children, desperate for work. You know, I think the sending countries were mostly Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador. Yeah, the kids were cleaning the meat processing plant, cleaning these, you know, grisly tools that cut up animals, render animals, and they were using caustic chemicals. So that was very disturbing, this report from Department of Labor. But then Hannah Dreyer, a New York Times reporter, did a series of exposés that ended up winning her the Pulitzer Prize. And she found kids working in 20 different states, doing all kinds of hazardous labor, children as roofers, children working in auto supply factories, and meat processing as well. So we've seen kids in lots of dangerous situations.
Reed Mackey, does the coalition focus on both national and state concerns?
Yes, we're working at both levels. You know, I will tell you at the state level, it's challenging because there are so many states and their assembly calendars are all somewhat different, and their protocols for passing legislation are all slightly different. So we really often rely on a partner within that state to really be on top of things.
So you said this big Department of Labor investigation came under the Biden administration. Have you seen any indication yet of what the Trump administration would do about child labor, if anything?
Yes, we're very afraid right now that there's very little enforcement going on. If it's happening in the Department of Labor, Wage and Hour Division, they're not talking about it, which is a critical part of reducing child labor. If you have an enforcement action, you have to talk about it. You have to do a press release. You have to let the business community know that child labor laws are being enforced. And so we're not seeing that. You know, we're not seeing any evidence of enforcement. So that means that it's either not happening or they just don't want people to know about it. And it's going to have an effect where the business community stops paying attention to child labor law. We're going to see, I think, more rampant child labor violations in the future if that doesn't change. Another factor is that the number of inspectors, labor inspectors by the Department of Labor has been dropping. And it, you know, it's been dropping for a while, but in the Biden administration, it was in the low 700s. And we think by the end of the Biden administration, it had dropped to the mid 600s. Our guess is that that's dropping considerably under the Trump administration. And we are hearing that they're not renewing some of the state, that federal Department of Labor has sometimes offices in the states to help enforce the child labor laws, other labor laws. And those leases are not being renewed. Those offices are closing. So it seems like there is a significant retraction in the labor inspectorate going on right now.
That was Reed Mackey, Director of Child Labor Advocacy for the Child Labor Coalition, a co-founder of the campaign to end U.S. child labor. Learn more about the attack on child labor laws in the U.S. by visiting our Between the Lines website at btl.com. www.ClimateOnline.org. Opus Dei is a controversial, small but powerful conservative organization within the Catholic Church, founded in Spain by José María Escrivá in 1928. The secretive cult-like sect's members practice corporal mortification, or self-inflicted pain as a form of penance, as depicted in the movie The Da Vinci Code. Opus Dei members have been accused of sexual abuse and exploitation of adolescent girls in several countries around the world. In its early years, Opus Dei had close ties with Spain's dictator, General Francisco Franco, where several of the group's members were appointed ministers in his fascist government. The sect has often been accused of supporting brutal right-wing military regimes in Chile, Argentina, and other nations across Latin America, charges that Opus Dei denies. In his new book titled Opus, The Cult of Dark Money, Human Trafficking and Right-Wing Conspiracy Inside the Catholic Church, Gareth Gore, a London-based investigative journalist, examines the group's radical agenda, cult-like practices, and its role in the collapse of one of Spain's largest banks. Your reporter spoke with Gore, who talks about the rising influence of Opus Dei in Donald Trump's right-wing U.S. MAGA movement, the late Pope Francis's criticism of Opus Dei, and speculation on who the College of Cardinals may elect as the Church's next pope.
So Opus Dei came of age in 1930 Spain, which was a society that was on the brink of civil war. You had progressives fighting conservatives in the streets. And Escrivá, the Spanish priest who founded Opus Dei, he saw the movement as a kind of reactionary guerrilla army who would fight against the progressives. He saw the membership as infiltrating every element of society, from politics to the judiciary, the world of business, journalism, and using their positions there to really kind of push a reactionary agenda. And that's very similar to what's happening in the States right now. Escrivá, back in the 30s, he was a conspiracy theorist. He thought Spain was being overrun by Bolsheviks, communists, and Jews. He thought they'd kind of taken over the levers of society. And, you know, it's a very similar narrative to the one being pushed by the MAGA movement now. It's all about how the progressives have taken over the universities, and they've taken over the judiciary, and they've taken over politics. You know, the things that were driving Opus Dei in the 1930 Spain are very much alive and well right now. I mean, it's a very similar dynamic right now, I would argue, in the States. What they want to achieve, who knows? I don't want people to think that there's some guy in Rome, the head of Opus Dei, issuing orders for Leonard Leo or for any of these other people affiliated to Opus Dei. It doesn't work like that. I think the best way of thinking about Opus Dei is as a network of like-minded individuals. And the organization kind of feeds those individuals with a philosophy, for want of a better word, and pushes them kind of in the right direction. It's about kind of bringing together a group of like-minded radicals who are willing to go out there and fight against the progressives. A number of the Project 2025 chapters were written by either members of Opus Dei or people affiliated to Opus Dei. And so I think there you can see really what kind of an agenda this network of people are really intent on pushing.
The College of Cardinals will soon meet in the Vatican to select Pope Francis's successor. During his papacy, Pope Francis, as you talked about in the book, had expressed concerns about Opus Dei, its conduct and charges of abuse. Briefly tell us about the divisions within the Catholic Church when it comes to Opus Dei between the progressive reformists and conservative forces, and how that could influence the selection of the next pope. And of course, what's at stake for Opus Dei in terms of who that next pope will be, in terms of the possible criticism or isolation that the next pope could confer on Opus Dei?
So Opus Dei has been locked in a bitter conflict with Pope Francis for a number of years. So Francis was aware of the abuses within Opus Dei and he was trying to do something about it. So he, in 2022, he issued a decree and basically ordered Opus Dei to clean up and to reform, to rewrite its statutes. Opus Dei dragged its feet. I think they were playing the long game. They thought, here's a 80-odd-year-old pope. He's not in the best of health. Let's just wait. He may not be around long enough to push through these reforms. He lost patience. A year later, he issued another decree, again ordering them to rewrite their statutes. Again, they dragged their feet. Now, what's interesting is that recently the Vatican has basically forced Opus Dei to actually kind of get to work and to redraw the statutes. Next week, they were due to vote on this new set of statutes that the Vatican has basically forced down their throats. When the Pope passed, within 24 hours of the Pope dying, Opus Dei cancelled the meeting to vote on the new statutes. Opus Dei has basically been given a second life. It was about to be heavily reformed. Francis was pushing that through, and the death of Francis opens the door to maybe it surviving intact without having to reform. As you mentioned, over the next couple of weeks, the cardinals will be meeting to vote on the next pope, about 130 cardinals from around the world. Now, I'm kind of naively, perhaps optimistic that they're probably going to elect maybe not someone quite as progressive as Francis, but I very much doubt that the next pope will be an arch conservative because of those approximately 130 cardinals who will vote, about 110 of them were actually handpicked by Francis himself.
That was Gareth Gore, a London-based investigative journalist and author of Opus, The Cult of Dark Money, Human Trafficking, and Right-Wing Conspiracy Inside the Catholic Church. Learn more about Opus Dei's influence inside the Catholic Church in U.S. politics by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Blue Sky at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WESU in Middletown, Connecticut, WFMP in Louisville, Kentucky, KPRI in Pella, California, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.